Hello, welcome to Holton Village. Today is Tuesday, July 28th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Mary Boyce. Session number is 98-6 and is titled, How and Why Christians and Jews Separated. Let's listen in.
For the sake of the person who is taping, you can start now. My name is Mary Boyce. This is my second week and my first time overall at Holton Village, and I'm having a wonderful time. And I'm not personally responsible for bringing the clouds this morning, but I think we all rejoice in just a little diminishment of the heat. So it might be just a little easier to address a topic that is fairly complicated, but I think one that, because of its very complexity, stretches us for some new ways of imagining how we ourselves started as a Christian people. This is part of a longer project of mine. It's a little heavy for the summer fair of Holton, but so far I haven't gotten any tomatoes thrown, so I consider myself fortunate. Of course, you never know what could happen on a given day, so I don't want to... So today, what I would like us to focus on, and please stop me at any point if there are questions of clarification or implication and so forth, and if you can sit by somebody who has a Bible and if we could pretend we're Christians and share, for those of you who have the resources, that would be all the better. This is not simply going to be a text study today, in fact, but what I have done, I've written on the board a few citations that... We may or may not get to these, but at least you kind of know that these are texts that have helped me to shape this analysis. I've been involved for some time now in trying to rethink, as a Christian, who we are in relationship to Jews, because I think that the storyline that we received about our beginnings, and particularly the story we understood about Judaism that was sort of the subtext of that, is very distorted. And that even though there is much around in biblical studies today that really overturns this almost thoroughly, by and large that has not somehow made it to the center of the churches. I did a little experiment yesterday. I see a few people who qualify at least for some degree of merit by returning today. I don't know if the people who are masochistic or what the particular issue is here, but we went through a kind of a rendition that I wrote up about sort of the oversimplified version, and people agreed, yes, in general, despite the differences in our denominational backgrounds, that's sort of the story we inherited. And then what I proposed was an alternative version, which is unfortunately more complicated and therefore more difficult to tell. And when I went home yesterday afternoon, we also did this in the heat of the afternoon, which made it especially challenging yesterday. And I went home and I said, gee, that was a lot of work to try to explain this simply, I sort of gave almost 25 minutes to that second account. And I looked at the manuscript that I'm working on, and I have written 150 pages to explain it. So I only boiled down 150 pages into 25 minutes. That's why I live in New York City. I can talk fast now. However, I'm happy to slow down, and you might have to help me slow down. So if you have a question or comment, please don't hesitate. I'd rather we did well what we did rather than race through to the end. Today's topic in particular, I wanted to focus, for those of you who were here yesterday, on the what happens when Christianity begins to separate from Judaism. But I'd like to make a few clarifications to start with. And first I'd like to just prime the pump, as it were, by having us think for a minute about how complicated relationships are. When I started thinking about how to shape this presentation, I wrote in my notes, why does a relationship end? And of course, there are many reasons why relationships end. And then I immediately penned in, well, do relationships ever really end? The intensity of the relationship might end, the friendship might end. But there's a way, particularly if it's been a very deep relationship in your life, it never goes away. And I remembered a play that I saw years and years ago. I Never Sang for My Father. I think it was also a film. And the beginning goes something like this. I mean, it's been years since I've even thought of this, so I would not die for the exactitude of this quote, that death ends a life, but it does not end a relationship that goes on and on in the mind of the survivor. And I think that that complexity and layered character of all relationships is especially helpful if we start to look back at our beginnings as Christian people, coming fully sprung, as it were, from Judaism, and to realize that that relationship is a lot more complicated. We sort of, I think, inherited that somewhere along the line there was a magic moment in which the Jews who were believers in Jesus, all of a sudden they knew they were Christians, and there were two distinct religions, and the paths parted, and we just have kept going along separate paths. And as we talked yesterday, a number of people pointed out that in their own understanding of Christianity as they inherited it, pretty much, once there's Jesus and maybe once there's Paul, particularly, Judaism sort of ends. It ceases to become something we think about anymore. Who was it that put it quite colorful yesterday? The train came, the Jews missed it, we got on it, we're rolling, and they're back there. They're still at the train, at the station, waiting for the Messiah. Well, I embellished that a little bit. Okay, so the first thing I'd like to point out this morning is that I would like to complexify this a little bit by saying that the separation, as it were, is more complex because it does not just involve one single issue. Just as usually in most relationships when we part ways with somebody, it does not involve just one single issue. So it's the partings of the ways. But before I get into that, I thought I might tell a story, and it involves a very long scripture text, John 9. And rather than use the hour to read you John 9 in its entirety, I thought that you might want to just sort of take a look at the text while I tell a little bit of the story. And this happened about 5 or 6 years ago. I was invited along with a Jewish scholar to go down to Boca Raton, Florida in February. Well, someone has to do the hard things in the church. And I've always felt a deep call to the Caribbean, so this was closer at least, and at any rate. However, the weather wasn't very good. But anyway, and this was what had become an annual event between a very large synagogue, a Reformed synagogue, and a Catholic church, and they were across the street from one another, and their interreligious relationship had begun because on the great feasts of the respective traditions, they had to share parking lots. Right? At Rosh Hashanah, the Jews had to use the parking lot of St. Joan the Arc and St. Joan of Arc and the other way around at Christmas and Easter and so forth. So at any rate, they had started these study sessions. So we were invited, the two of us, to come and do some workshops, and I was to preach in the synagogue on Friday, and then we gave a workshop. It was really quite a lot of work. And then I was also asked to preach at some of the masses, some of the services of the Eucharist on Sunday. Now, just to show you how large this congregation is, between Saturday night and Sunday evening, they have 11 services. So I can be generous, but I didn't see myself preaching at 11. I thought by the time I ended it, I couldn't even put a sentence together. So I did 5 of them. And I haven't gone to church since. No. And I believe you get it all in at once. And then I'm not semi-Pelagian, I'm just Pelagian. All right. So anyway, the gospel text for that day, so we just went from the lectionary text, was the 9th chapter of the Gospel of John. Now remember the setting. There's been a Jewish-Christian thing going on, which actually relatively few parishioners probably had known much about. But at any rate, so here's the text, and here's the challenge. This is a text, as you read down, that has some sort of problematic things in it about the Jews. Now, I'm sure this is a very familiar text to you because it's such an actually wonderful text in terms of the narrative. But the particular problem of the text starts in verse 18. The Jews did not believe he had been blind, our poor blind beggar, and had received his sight until they called the parents of the man who had received his sight and asked them, "Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?" His parents answered, talk about mealy-mouthed, "We know that this is our son," well, "and that he was born blind, but we do not know how it is that he now sees, nor do we know who opened his eyes. Ask him, he is of age. He will speak for himself." And then the editorial comment in verse 22. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that anyone who confessed Jesus to be the Messiah would be put out to the synagogue. Now, there's another thing that makes this difficult. In the Catholic tradition, brevity is a virtue. 10 minutes is good. 12 minutes is stretching it. 15, it better be extraordinary. So, you know, this is the fourth Sunday of Lent. There are two other lections. I can't just speak about this particular verse. I have to say something about the fuller context. And so I did, and then I put in, sort of toward the end of the homily, some explanation of this verse. So at the end of each of the services that I preached, I stood at the back with the presider and so forth and shook hands, and people said whatever they said at the end. And, you know, they're going to be nice because I'm going to leave again, so you know, what do they care? And the only time that I noticed any difference was at the principal service, the 11 o'clock service. And at that service on that day, the choir from the synagogue sang at the Eucharist. And the cantor from the synagogue led much of the music, just as on Friday night, the choir from the Catholic parish had come across the street and done the sung at the synagogue. And so in the congregation, there were many friends and spouses and so forth of the choir members. Now, I gave more or less, I spoke from notes and not from a full text, but I gave more or less, this, I mean, I only have so many ideas in a given period, so I said more or less the same thing at each of the services. At the end of the 11 o'clock, almost everybody who came up to me from that parish said, "I am so glad you explained that verse about the parents and about Jews being expelled from the synagogue, because when I heard it, I was horrified. This was in our text, and we had Jews with us." Now, that has set me to thinking that we have actually a lot of problematic texts along this line in the lectionary, and in also, of course, in the fuller text of the New Testament that doesn't necessarily make it to the lectionary. But I think they kind of roll off of us for the most part. We don't hear them. And one of the reasons we don't hear them is because we sort of have this old storyline about the Jews missing the train. And we don't think about them very much, and so this isn't sort of a problem to us. So let me use this as an entry point, and one of the things that I find is a very useful exercise is whenever you hear a text proclaimed, particularly in a liturgical context, imagine that a Jew is standing next to you. What happens when, as has happened to me, a very, very close Jewish friend accompanies me to a service, and one of the texts is read in which the Pharisees are shown to be hypocrites? I mean, there are many texts you could use for that. Well, I mean, you know, I'm of course, you know, whenever you have a friend from another tradition, you bring another sensitivity to it. So I'm just going to leave this kind of, I'm going to sort of plop that out here and just let that stay for a moment. So what I want to suggest is that John 9 gives us a clue that's in some ways misleading if we read this as a historical, factual account of how it happened, because it suggests to us that in the time of Jesus himself, so somewhere, say, in the early 30s, there was already this problem between what's coming to be called Christians and Christianity and the followers of Jesus, and that it's already reached such an explosive point that if anyone confessed Jesus to be the Messiah, they would be put out of the synagogue. Now, what's misleading about that is that this is not really about that early part, that first third of the first century. This probably reflects a problem in the community out of which this gospel, the fourth gospel of John, comes to be written. It may be that by that time, in this particular area, wherever it was, since we don't know for sure, that there was tension now, probably in the late 80s and 90s, between people who, Jews, who confessed Jesus to be the Messiah, and other Jews who said, no, this is out of bounds. You've gone too far now. Now, what we talked about yesterday is that there was a period, particularly in the 60s, particularly before the destruction of the temple and so forth in the year 70. So between the death of Jesus and, say, the late 60s, when the believers in Jesus debated each other with great vigor about who were they in relationship to the tradition in which they had grown up, the Jewish tradition. And particularly the question gets hot when it comes to the people who come into their community who weren't formed by those traditions, the non-Jews or the Gentiles. So the first clarification I want to make is that this is a messy process that we're going to have trouble saying exactly this happened at exactly this time. But I think that we can be quite sure that a text such as John 9 is not about the historical Jesus preaching in first century Palestine in the early 30s, that this particular text is now a layer reflecting John's community. Let me stop there just to make sure everybody is sort of on our train. Yes?
Yeah, can you tell me why, it sounds like a naive question, but why I care that I was put out of the synagogue? What happened to me?
Well, think of it as a family thing, as a starter. Remember, we're talking for the most part very close-knit areas, you know, where people are so much more interdependent than we are in our world, particularly in our large urban areas. So if you come from a family that takes Torah seriously, that practices certain, you know, take the very simple thing of eating. And this is, you know, let's face it, food is at the heart of a lot, you know, the scripture study this morning involved hunger. You know, food has a great deal to do with how we practice, you know, in the ordinary ways, our religious commitments. So, supposing that your family, as would have been typical of most first century Palestinian Jews, it keeps the dietary laws. But all of a sudden, you, under the influence of this charismatic preacher named Paul, you decide that you're free from them. Or at least you come home with Gentile friends who are also believers in Jesus. And now the question is, can you all eat at the same table? It's a very real problem. But, you know, think of us today as Jews, not as Jews and Christians, as Christians. We have, if you study practicing our faith, all of those practices are common to the Christian traditions, various Christian traditions. But how we live them out in our particulars, we do disagree a little bit. How is forgiveness mediated in a particular community of faith? Is confession of sin to a priest some way necessary or not necessary? And we've argued a great deal about that, and we've parted ways because of those things. I mean, it seems to me that the churches, for the most part, the Christian traditions, have parted from one another more over practices than over, you know, I don't think there's a great deal of difference between most, in the thinking of most Christians about the Trinity. Mostly because we don't know how to think about it, too. So it's, when faith comes down to the very ordinary realm, or it's not faith at all, seems to me, it's something head cramping. So you're going to care a lot if you get thrown out of the synagogue because your identity is very closely connected with it. And not only your religious identity, your ethnic identity. So it's not a good thing to be thrown out of the synagogue, okay? Any other things that you want to clarify before I move on a bit?
Mary, I think in our own...
I thought it was the voice of God, but it's Susan, so it's the same thing.
I was just thinking in response to your question, a number of my friends who were formerly Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, who there was a point at which their understanding of Scripture or their practice or their belief meant they had to leave their church. They were asked to leave their church. And it wrenched them. It divided families. It cut them off from their religious history and formation at some deep level. There was a way in which their very home now was no longer open to them. And the pain, years later, remains deep. So, I was just thinking of a modern experience in my own denomination where doctrine of the Trinity, let's say, was not in question, but ordination of women was. And even though, and many stayed, too, because they couldn't bear to be cast out, even though they no longer felt completely at home anymore. And deep honest, divided families, divided communities, divided memory. And it led them into a divided future. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what I think is happening for those being thrown out of the synagogue. Forced to choose, and even in very intimate relationships.
And the pain's on both sides.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So it's very helpful to take whatever pain we know of from splits within our own communities or within our own families, if it's not necessarily about a religious thing, and use that as a kind of an emotional analogy to help us understand some of what our ancestors in faith went through. For the most part, it is not simply a matter of being thrown out of the synagogue, and that's why I want to be careful with what I'm doing with this John 9 text. Because Judaism in the first century was not organized in such a way that you ever had any kind of authoritative body that had the power to decree that in all synagogues throughout the land, anybody who confesses Jesus as the Messiah is out. This probably reflects what's happening in a particular region at a particular time. It's not, you can't universalize from it. Yes?
When you get into those kinds of family ethnic disputes, the language then too becomes much more strident. And so rather than being an intellectual and objective analysis, it now is more from the gut than from the head. Mm-hmm. And if we read those texts as being from the head, we do damage to the intent.
And it's going to intensify, particularly when you go into the second and third centuries, when it becomes a real serious rivalry. Now, this isn't as evident in each gospel text. It's not as evident in, say, something like Mark. But in Matthew and in John particularly, to a certain extent in Luke, Acts as well, they have an argument with other Jews. But particularly, I think, in Matthew's case, I follow those scholars who suggest to us that we should read Matthew, which, by the way, has some quite anti-Jewish texts. The denunciation of the Pharisees in chapter 3, Pilate washing his hands, and the blood curse, his blood be upon us, in the Passion account. That Matthew's gospel was probably written by Jews who believed in Jesus and were arguing over against many of their other colleagues, saying, this is the right way to read Torah. Jesus is the way to read Torah. And the rest of the community isn't buying it, but they're on the margins. And when you read it as an inner document, rather than us versus them, the polemic becomes more understandable. It also makes us wonder, what are the effects of the polemics we use today within our own communities? I mean, I'm convinced, I work enough in ecumenical settings, that maybe this is it's probably irresponsible generalization, but I won't let it stop me, that it may well be that no matter what the denominational differences here in this room now, or in Holden Village this week, we have more in common with one another than in many cases we do with certain of our companions in our own denomination. Right? And sometimes the way we talk to one another within our own denominations, I would say, lacks charity. And that's putting it charitably, okay? I, of course, have never been guilty of that, but others have been. Now, let me very quickly, I found a great line, by the way, and I was reading a Wallace Stegner novel last week called Recapitulation. And there's this great line that I'm going to try to use about what I'm trying to do today, a moment of complicated clarity. That's what I'm aiming for, a moment of complicated clarity. So I'm going to try to put some clarity around an issue that's so complicated and that we don't have enough data to be sure of all of this, so we can make educated guesses. Now, this is not an educated guesses. I think this is a fairly responsible conceptual framework. One way to understand Judaism of the first century, but also to a certain extent modern Judaism, is to think of it as a constellation, a configuration of practices and beliefs regarding Torah, monotheism, covenant, and temple. And then to see that Torah, monotheism, covenant, and temple were carried in three central practices. There were other practices, but these are three that were central to Judaism of the first century and remain, although in varying ways among Jewish groups, also important. The observance of Sabbath, which is a fundamental reminder of who you are as a people and a fundamental reminder of the one God. Circumcision, which does not happen to everybody in the community. It excludes certain, excludes the women, but it, and we don't know the origins of this practice. It was not distinct, it's not unique to Jews. We know that in Egypt and certain Egyptian religions, they practiced it and so forth. But, and you know from the early church, this was a big issue. When the Gentiles come to be believers in Jesus, one of the sticking points, I have to be careful with my analogy, one of the issues was, you know, one time I was trying, when I was teaching at Boston College, I was trying to tease the undergraduates into using, expansive language. With a name like Boys, this is a tough road to hoe, but at any rate. So anyway, they thought I was nuts. They never heard of all of this. But anyway, they thought, oh, well, she's crazy, but she's our teacher, so you don't want to get a B in theology. And so I got this paper about the person being circumcised, he, she. I'll leave nothing to chance. Okay, and purity norms. And the purity norms, which I think are particularly difficult, and I can't stop here to explain all of them, they're particularly difficult for moderns in the West to understand, but I think if you, to make a connection with practices, if you think of them as the Jewish equivalent of household economics in the first century, or at least some aspect of household economics, and particularly important among the so-called rules of purity, or rules that kept you, that kept you separated, distinctive, because you don't want to assimilate. Jews are at most 5 to 7% in the Roman Empire. So you're a minority group, you're an illicit religion. The Romans actually allowed them a considerable amount of freedom of practice. But it's very important that you have some outward boundary markers that give you a sense of who you are. And the dietary laws, these are things we eat, and these are things we don't eat, and this is the way we eat together, and this is the way we don't eat together, gave them a sense of family identity, of ethnic, religious identity. Since I've been here, I've learned a little bit about differences between Scandinavian Lutherans and German Lutherans. Some of them are around food things, right? You know, I don't know that much, but I heard about it from, you know, it depends who you hear it from, how the differences are talked about, right? I gotta get out of this real fast. I can see maybe I need to take the book tomorrow. Now, what I'd like to suggest to you is that the partings of the ways did not first happen, as we probably all think, over whether Jesus was the Messiah, or Jesus as the Son of God, or over a claim about Jesus as the Christ of God. That the division between believers in Jesus, who are called Christians, but who for quite some time are not entirely separate, many of whom still think of themselves as Jews, and those who remain sort of fully in the Jewish community and do not identify with the teachings of Jesus and his reform movement or his renewal movement, that this happens very gradually over some very specific issues. And one of the first issues that becomes problematic is the temple, and what happens in the temple, of course, which is sacrifice. So here it might be useful to go to a set of texts, again, because of the limitations of time, I won't read all of these, but Acts 7, the full chapter really, which is the speech of Stephen, but particularly verse 48, and then look at some texts. I selected a number of texts from 1 Corinthians just so we could stay with one letter instead of flipping a bit. Now, in Acts 7:48, you have this long speech of Stephen, which in some ways sort of summarizes the history. Stephen is portrayed in Acts as a Jew who has become a believer of Jesus, but he is a Jew from the Greek. He's not a Palestinian Jew. He's a Hellenistic Jew. He's a Greek-influenced Jew. And we know from Acts 6, the first two verses, that there have been tensions in the Jewish community between Hellenistic Jews and Hebrews, or what probably this comes down to is that Hellenistic Jews perhaps were more influenced. They probably came from maybe more urban areas. They were the Greek-speaking Jews who were maybe in one way more sophisticated or had more interactions with the Gentile world. And the Hebrew-speaking or probably Aramaic-speaking Jews had less interaction. And you know, in any community, when you have one group that's more involved with outsiders, then there are going to be some other differences about how you understand identity. And so there were some tensions among them. I guess, again, if I can... it's always dangerous to use, and you know, there are tensions within any religion. I can think of as a Catholic that the way I grew up is sort of an ethnic mongrel, but Anglo. When I go to a Hispanic Eucharist in, that's you know, for the say Spanish-speaking members of my congregation, there are just some things I don't identify with. Not because they're wrong or I'm right, but just, you know, there are ways of worship that belong with Hispanic peoples that, you know. Or as I say to one of my friends who's a black Catholic, you expect us to use our bodies? You want me to move? You want a 3-hour service? You know, I mean, and you know, we tease about it, but you know, there are ways we're, so that the tension between the Hellenists and the Hebrew speaking was similar to that. So Stephen is a Hellenist, and one of the things that seems to have gone with the Hellenist worldview is that they were just less involved in the temple. And last week I had a lot of fun with the temple because there were so many opinions in Judaism about the temple. You know, there was a group down at the Dead Sea that thought all the priests at the temple were totally corrupt, and they say some of the nastiest things you could ever imagine about the priests. They make the rest of us look so pro-clerical, no matter what criticisms we may ever have in our minds. And then other Jews who were very involved. I mean, so the temple was one of those things that was a sort of a flashpoint. So Stephen is not enamored of the temple, particularly. And in verse 48, he says something that's actually quite dramatic. You know, you have, beginning with verse 44, our ancestors had the tent of testimony, and then Joshua, and then there was David, who found favor with God, and then Solomon, who built a house for him. And then verse 48, yet the Most High does not dwell in houses made with human hands, as the prophet says. And then, of course, you know, they use any text, I mean, text ready at hand. It doesn't exactly prove it, but that's, you know, this is how our ancestors in faith use the text. Now think about that for a minute. The Most High does not dwell in houses made with human hands. Puts all of us in a little a sticky situation, does it not? Moreover, the word that's used in the Greek for made with human hands is the very word that Jews, Hellenistic Jews, Greek-speaking Jews, used for idolatry. So he's really saying to those who still went to the temple, you're doing something idolatrous. Okay, so this is one of the first indications. A second indication that probably has much less to do with tension and more to do with now the community reflecting on its heritage and trying to make sense of the, you know, what is the meaning of the temple to the believers in Jesus? Because the temple, well, I think Jesus went to the temple, and did sacrifices and so forth, as were requisite, he isn't particularly involved with temple activity. It's not a big item in his life. So Paul does some very interesting things with the temple. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 3, 16 to 17. So much fun not to be teaching undergraduates, you know, they'd be looking through Genesis. Okay. Do you not know that you are God's temple and that God's Spirit dwells in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy that person, for God's temple is holy and you are that temple. Do you see what Paul has now moved from the sort of the spatial reality of the temple in Jerusalem to the follower of Jesus, himself or herself, being the temple? So there's been a spiritualization of this, and I don't mean this as a bad thing, or, you know, he's taken a very important reality in Jewish life and now given it a new meaning. And this is something that happens a great deal in the first two centuries. You take something that's in your tradition, but you have a new light on it. Similarly, Paul does a spiritualization of sacrifice. I think the text that's clearest for me about that, it's just in the next chapter, in the fifth chapter, actually, not quite the second chapter over, chapter 5, verse 7 and 8. We usually hear this in the Easter season. Do you not know that a little yeast, I'm starting with the second part of verse 6, a little yeast leavens the whole batch of dough? Clean out the old yeast so that you may be a new batch, as you really are unleavened, for our Paschal Lamb, Christ, has been sacrificed. So now, sacrifice, which has been a central activity of the Jewish people, is now, as it were, taken up totally in Jesus. He is the sacrifice. And in Romans, there are some Roman texts in Romans that I will just point to, but I'm not going to get into Romans with all these Lutherans around. I'm convinced that you only get Romans really deeply if you were raised as a Lutheran. It's kind of have to be in your mother's breast. It's like for a Jew, you know, I can't eat gefilte fish very well. You know, you have to have it in, you know. So, seriously, I don't have time to do all these texts, but that the notion that Christ has become sin for us, which I think is really, really difficult, I think it has to do with being a sin offering. So that the sacrifices in the temple, and one of the other things that's happening, by the way, as the first century proceeds, by the year 70, there's no temple anymore. So when Paul first uses it, there's both the temple and we ourselves as temple. But now, when there's no temple, I think that the believers in Jesus are going to hear this in another way, and particularly the younger generation. Okay. Then for the time, the text that, again, that I don't have enough time to get to, but if you read Hebrews, the letter to the Hebrews, the chapters that in particular that are important in this respect are chapters 9 and 10. And there the writer to the Hebrews was clearly influenced by Greek ways, and the Greeks in general were not, sacrifice was not a big feature of this time, and they looked down on it. It was just too, embodied for them. It was too material, too sensual. You know, sometimes I have a very difficult time in many respects. I can't imagine going to the temple myself and offering an animal sacrifice. First of all, I'm a city girl. I know if I buy chicken, I know how you get a chicken. It's in the meat market already, you know, killed, plucked, and all of that. You know, so I just can't imagine the smell and the sights and the sounds. So I just have to say, wait a minute, I'm being ethnocentric. I can't imagine it. That's my problem. But the other thing is that sometimes I go to a liturgy. It's so dead. It's so, if you will, anemic. I used the line last week from Annie Dillard that I just love about the church is like a group of brainless tourists on a package tour of the absolute. The church is like a group of children playing with chemistry sets of TNT and not knowing what they're doing. I mean, you know, we use all this magnificent language about God and forgiveness and mercy, and they're just kind of, you know, we're just saying the words. It's not like... And then at the end of that quote, she says something, that we should all wear crash helmets to church. The ushers should lash us to our pews. I mean, we should have this sense of real power going on. And the more I look back on what was happening in the temple, whatever else you want to say about it, there was this sense of power. You know, you see blood poured out on the altar. Now, instead of just, you know, feeling abhorrent about it, here it is, the sign of life right there. I'm not suggesting we go back to this. I don't suggest that at all. But you can see that maybe we haven't done justice. You know, we think of primitive peoples. Well, maybe our way of worship is so ascetic, I mean, so anemic, and so sterile, that what we need is to be more primitive, if you will.
But from the Hellenistic point of view, that would have been really more from the peasant. The sacrifice would have been more from the peasant people. The Hellenistic point of view would have been more more educational.
Yeah, more rational. Rational.
Yeah, absolutely more rational. And so for them, I think the sacrifice was just beneath them. There was no rational reason to do that.
So, and I think that's what Hebrews does, and then it layers all of this with, well, now Jesus has made all of this irrelevant. And Jesus is the great high priest, and you don't have to have all these goings on in the temple. Now, Hebrews is written, we don't know exactly when, but it's written late in the first century. So, I think you could say that by late in the first century, the first parting of the way was going on, particularly probably in Palestine, because that's where the temple mattered more. So now there's a break. Believers in Jesus are going to put less stock in the temple, especially those influenced by the more Greek mentality. I want to be careful about putting Greek and Jew in separate categories, because there were a lot of Jews who were influenced by this as well. So, but let's just say that the more rational, less visceral approach to sacrifice, then using also Paul's way of extending the metaphor to one's person, now becomes so probably by the 90s, between believers, some believers in Jesus and other Jews, there was quite a distinctive party. But this is not now enough of a party to make two separate religious groups. The second party happens over what does it mean to be in the covenant, and it's particularly connected with these two boundary markers of the covenant people. If you are God's people, you can't just be God's people in general. You have to have some indices of peoplehood to be holy as the Lord your God. And one of the ways that holiness came down to the ordinary life was through what you, how you respected the dead, how you treated the dead, who touched the corpse, how you respected the flow of blood, and what you ate and what you didn't eat. So the big question becomes, for believers in Jesus, how much of these boundary markers of peoplehood are necessary for people who believe in Jesus? And here the classic text is in Paul's letter to the Galatians, and I'm mindful that time is moving on, but I think it's very important to look at this text, and it's certainly been an important text in the Lutheran life. Now, I just want to do a little editorial on this. Sometimes we're scandalized that Christians are divided from one another, and that we differ. You know, somehow we think romantically that we should all be, you know, of one mind and one soul and praising God daily and all of this, you know, sharing all our possessions. I'm not against those realities. But let's just remember that here we have the biggies. Peter, James, John, Paul, violently, I don't mean physically, but vociferously disagreeing with one another. And what were they disagreeing about? They were disagreeing about what should be our identity markers as believers in Jesus. So again, not to look at the entire text, actually, the first part of Galatians is wonderful. And I've always loved the beginning of the third chapter. My translation, which is the New Revised Standard Version, says, "You foolish Galatians." But I can't remember which translation it was. Years ago, I found one that said, "Oh, my dear stupid Galatians." Okay, so skim and go down to verse 7. It's funny how these Bibles, they're making the numbers smaller. "On the contrary, when they saw that I had been entrusted with the gospel for the uncircumcised, for the Gentiles, just as Peter had been entrusted with the gospel for the circumcised, parentheses, for he who worked through Peter, making him an apostle to the circumcised, also worked through me in sending me to the Gentiles." Aha, he got his credentials here. "And when James and Cephas and John, who were acknowledged pillars," not quite the way Paul was, you know, "recognized the grace that had been given to me, they gave to Barnabas and me the right hand of fellowship, agreeing that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. They asked only one thing, that we remember the poor, which was actually what I was eager to do." So that was 14 years ago. That was the agreement. We'll split up the territory. You take the uncircumcised. And as long as, you know, we all give to the poor, we're fine. Okay? Then, verse 11. "But when Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood self-condemned." Now, I don't think this is how Cephas would have written it. But Paul won because we got his letter. "For until certain people came from James," well, it's not Cephas's fault, it's James' fault, "he used to eat with the Gentiles." By the way, there's also a text in 1 Corinthians in which Paul talks about not sitting down to the table to eat with immoral people, which is very interesting in light of how Jesus...
Yeah.
You know, Jesus eats with a few people at his table that really were, I mean, shouldn't have been eating with them, you know. I mean, they were sinners, tax collectors, prostitutes, other immoral people. So you can see how the Christian community is always trying to figure out how, you know, if you see what happens is when you're not yet illicit religion and you're a tiny minority group, if you're sitting down at the table and you've got a lot of immoral folks, think of the reputation. You know, you get the wrong people in your churches. Very bad. So, you know, these are problems we all deal with. But Cephas used to eat with the Gentiles, but after they came, James and John, presumably, was mentioned above, he drew back and kept himself separate for fear of the circumcision faction. So there's apparently a group in among the believers in Jesus who are arguing that the only way for Gentiles to be fully a part of this community is to do everything the way we did it. Now, how unlike the churches, right? We never have anybody say, "This is the way I learned it when I was young, and this is the right way to get the gospel." You've never heard that, right? It's not a problem. It's only a problem in Catholicism. Okay. "And the other Jews joined him in the hypocrisy." This is not what you could call an objective rendering of the controversy. This is Paul's. "So that even Barnabas was led astray by their hypocrisy. But when I saw they were not acting consistently with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas before them all, 'If you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile," that is, you eat with the Gentiles, "and not like a Jew, how can you compel the Gentiles to live like Jews?" So this controversy at Antioch is the beginning of a major, major departure in which something as seemingly ordinary as with whom you eat and what you eat and whether or not male members who come into the community should be circumcised become a kind of a point of division. What is behind the Reformation? Corrupt practices. Disagreement about practices. And then what happens after the Reformation? If you do it this way, we'll do it that way. That we're going to disagree. I mean, so again, I go back trying to tie this in with the theme. When we hold practice, Jews held these practices in common, Sabbath, circumcision, period, but they differed among one another in how you actually did it. what you could and couldn't do on the Sabbath to keep observance. And now the same thing is happening with believers in Jesus. And what happens at Antioch in the 60s is probably a second parting, but again, it's probably what happens particularly in the church around in Palestine and in Antioch. It's not necessarily generalizable. So, but it's the beginning of different boundary markers. So that in Christianity today, as a rule, we don't put any emphasis on what is eaten or not eaten in general. There are variations, but even where there are variations on that, they're not so central. Circumcision has ceased to become, I suppose, our analogy to this seems to me that baptism is to the Christian community, a circumcision is to the Jewish community, insofar as it's the rite of initiation. So supposing, this is just occurring to me in a moment, supposing some new teacher came along and said, when new members come into this congregation, baptism is not necessary. I mean, this is sort of the equivalent thing that's happening with Peter and Paul.
The non-denominational Christians do right now anyway. They do not recognize infant baptism.
Okay, so it's going to be a believer's baptism later in life. So this is a good analogy because baptism might be the one practice we all hold in common as Christians, or at least one of them. But we disagree rather vociferously on when, how, you're not really baptized unless you were totally immersed. And it is a little surprising to discover, as I have periodically, that certain fundamentals don't consider me a Christian. Mm-hmm. Not because they've watched me act. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe that could be justified. But simply by virtue of the fact that I think that I have a different creed. Mm-hmm. Sort of astounding, isn't it? If you think how we... So this notion of... this is one of the lessons that I think we can take from the first century, this predilection we have to define people in and out. And, you know, I think it's important not to romanticize what's going on in any community. The Jews today are struggling with this issue themselves. Orthodox Jews and some Orthodox Jews are defining out other Jews because they're not Torah observant. I actually had a rather great moment I have a very close Jewish friend who lives in Los Angeles. We do a lot of work together, and so she stays with me quite frequently when she comes to New York. So usually there are various things that I cut out of the paper or something, and knowing that she's coming in a few weeks. And the other day, not the other day, it was about a year ago, there was a group of Orthodox rabbis, all men, of course, dressed in black. And they were all kind of, have reached the amplitude of their lives. And they're sitting in chairs like this, and they have made pronouncements defining out all these other Jews as not being really, really Jews. And it was such a perfect picture of patriarchy. And I was a Catholic feminist. This was just great. I couldn't wait till Sarah got there and say, hey, you got it too, right? but what it is that we have to, you know, that we have to define each other in and out. Now, I want to say that so far that we've had two parties, but not a decisive breach. We're still in the first century. Late in the first century, and now going to go into the second and third and fourth centuries, the third and major break will happen over the question of monotheism. You knew sooner or later we were going to get there, or how are we going to talk about Jesus as God's Christ. But what a number of New Testament scholars say is that even something with as much emphasis on Jesus' oneness with God as is in the fourth gospel, which is probably the very last one written and late in the first century, even that still was within the boundaries of a very diverse way of thinking of Judaism in the first century. But more and more, as people began to confess Jesus as one with God and as Lord, you know, the confession Jesus as Lord comes early, comes with Paul. That still possible within Judaism. Resurrection was a Jewish concept among certain Jews. You know, it wasn't held by everybody, but it comes out of Judaism. But more and more, as Jesus' oneness with God is stressed, and in the second century, as both the rabbis sort of put some boundaries around Judaism, and as the Christian apologists begin to define it out, what happens is that there's more and more stress in the Christian community about Jesus as one with God, and therefore of God and God, divine. And the rabbis, on the other hand, are drawing the boundaries more carefully around Judaism. And so you now begin to have, in the second century, probably mid-second century, something more like a decisive breach. But, and I think this is fascinating, this probably happened maybe among the educated elite, maybe among Jewish leaders and Christian leaders. What the ordinary folks understood about it is very difficult to understand. I used one example yesterday. I'll repeat it and then give another one. We know from the writings of John Chrysostom, the late 4th century, that he is outraged, and he can give some pretty powerful denunciations, outraged by members of his congregation. Now, this is 4th century, who are still going to the synagogue on their feasts and festivals, and they're not coming to his church. In other words, the people in the pew, as it were, they're sort of less troubled by the distinctions that the scholars and leaders have made. Isn't that always how unlike our day? Some people have argued that in certain regions, like 8th, I read this the other day, I can only say that it's from a reputable scholar, I don't have the knowledge to be able to judge this, that as late as 8th century rural Syria, that the average Christian didn't necessarily think of himself or herself as Christian as separate from Jewish. And now that makes a lot of sense if you think about what the early world was like. You know, it doesn't go out from church headquarters on email. Okay, henceforth you are to think of yourself as a Christian separate, you know. In the big cities and where you have bishops and, you know, you have councils and so forth, how many people in the 4th century heard about the councils of Ephesus and Chalcedon and so forth? You know, we study them now and they give us ways of defining, but, you know, somebody, a peasant in rural Syria, you know, decrees didn't go, I mean, decrees went out from kings and so forth, but they kind of, you know. It's almost a time to end, and I should leave some more time for comments and questions, but what this does, it gives us a much more textured understanding of how we began. And it helps us to understand that Christianity didn't start in a moment, and it started over controversy about practices, and actually when the New Testament then, particularly the Gospels, when it writes about Jewish practices, tends to do it with a little polemical twist, because they're arguing with one another, and as you rightly pointed out, once the argument starts, being fair isn't the chief thing. You know? I mean, who fights fair in an argument? Oh, well, I do, but I mean, we do. Do you know what I mean? You know, you kind of embellish things. Pardon? We fight to win, that's right. Not us, though. So, time for questions or comments. Getting a little warm, but I think
this is sort of tangential, but back at the temple,
yeah.
Was the temple the only place that you sacrificed? The temple in Jerusalem? So if you were a Jew that lived in Rome, say, would you go periodically to the temple?
Well, yes and no. How's that for a...
Okay, and then when did that practice of sacrifice sort of die out of favor?
Well, that's the easiest question of all to answer. It ended in 70 because there was no more temple. When the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, there was a war between 66 and 70, between the Jews and the Romans. And the Romans won in a big way. In 70, Titus came in, they leveled Jerusalem, they burned everything, they expelled all Jews from Jerusalem, and that was the end of the temple and never. In fact, now, when you go to what's called the Temple Mount in the old city of Jerusalem, on the pinnacle of the temple, the high place, where the temple is the great shrine, one of the great shrines of Islam. And it's very interesting, and when you know you think of the Western Wall, so-called, not Jews don't like this, the Wailing Wall, you know. Those were the retaining walls, that was the retaining wall that Herod the Great built for his remodeling project. Some of the stones are 80 tons, it's just enormous. And this is just one little section, it's the only section that's left. And you stand at the retaining wall, this Western Wall, where people are praying, Jews are praying, and then you hear the muezzin, the call to prayer from the mosque, and you think, No wonder there are tensions in the Middle East. The holiest spot of Judaism traditionally has now been taken over by the Muslims. So, we think there were problems in the first century, you know, the 20th century. Just to answer one question about the temple, by the way. Particularly the Jews of Judea would have gone more regularly to the temple just because it was a lot easier to get there. Galilean Jews up north would have gone, you know, maybe they went on all the pilgrimage feasts. They probably more typically at least went for Passover. And many Jews from all over would have come for Passover, as we know from the texts around Pentecost and so forth. But the Samaritans, who were Jews, had their own temple on Mount Gerizim, and there was also a temple in Alexandria in Egypt. We don't know too much about that one, but there was really, when we talk about it, it's really the temple, but not everybody had here. And the people at Qumran were so disillusioned, they weren't going. And they had their own organization. And if you've ever known anybody to say, that's it, I am never going in this church again, well, you get the feeling that there were some Jews like that too. Well, thanks for your attentiveness, and this isn't exactly light fare for the summer, but I'm just very pleased to have you thinking out loud with me about this.
Do you have a book that you'd recommend, just a general history book that would kind of cover more of that?
This particular issue or
this
more
in particular issue?
There are two books in particular that I'd recommend, although they're both sort of heavy-duty reading. The first book from which I stole the title, Fair and Square, is called The Partings of the Way, and the author is James D.G. Dunn, D-U-N-N. He's a British scholar, I think a Methodist. The other is by Stephen Wilson, a Canadian. It's an excellent book called Related Strangers. It covers this period and also later. It's a wonderful book. For those of you too much footnoting just seems a bit over the top, a book I recommend very highly, although it's not just about this, doesn't touch as much on this particular issue, is a wonderful book called The Shadow of the Galilean. And it's fiction written by a biblical scholar, very responsible, trying to kind of get at the, and it gives you a real feel for the historical Jesus. And I've used it even with undergraduates who admitted freely to me that they liked it. Probably the first time in my life. The Shadow of the Galilean by Gerrit Thiessen, Theissen. He's written a lot of books, but this is his only one that's accessible, I think, across the board to people. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.